Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ladies and gentlemen, please remain standing for the singing of our national anthem.
Brexit means Brexit.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration in the history of our country.
Hi, hello, and welcome. My name is Royful Brown, and I am back in London. I'm back in the land of my birth, England, to discuss matters from my adopted home, the US, but also matters which are very germane and pertinent to Europe at the moment, the Russian invasion of Ukraine and exactly how that is going. Today, I have with me a smorgasbord of experts and friends. First off, we welcome back Carolina Vigora, who graced our podcast just two, three months ago, Carolina. Carolina, please remind us of your eminence and where you lecture.
Hello, everybody. It's very nice to be here again. I lecture at the Warsaw University, although now I'm on sabbatical and based in Berlin in the Robert Bosch Academy.
We're also joined by Michael Donahue. Michael, tell us the great podcast that you host. And I believe you had an eminent and entertaining guest on last week.
I did. We were really lucky to have one great Royfield Brown, but I still cannot spell your name, even though it is literally up front of my face. I still have trouble with it. So I host Tilting at Windmills, and the last episode was with Royfield, and it was a pretty engaging episode.
Thank you. This is a global show. And just to prove it, we've gone from Poland to America, and now we're going to go to Ouagadougou in West Africa. Ben Mendelsohn, how are you, sir? And why are you on my stage?
Well, thank you for inviting me. You are such a gracious host. I am here because you have enticed me to come here. And I have partaken in some more of your podcasting, which is expertly done. I can give you the viewpoint from here in Burkina Faso.
Got it. Thank you, Ben Mendelsohn. We're also joined by my good friend on this app, geopolitical expert and somewhat of a raconteur and author and somewhat of a change agent, Greg Sattell. Greg Sattell, what's the weather like in Philadelphia today?
It's always sunny in Philadelphia, Rufo, except for today when it's cloudy and unseasonably cold.
You know what? I need to get back to watching that. Great show. Great show indeed. And bringing up the rear, we have Andrea. Andrea, tell us about the best thing you've done today.
The best thing I had today was just a few minutes ago where I was having a conversation, imagining a world with more women leaders and what that might look like.
Huh. Not exactly an apropos topic, considering we're going to be focusing in on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, considering that the current Prime Minister of Finland is a single mother who's raised by a single mother and is head of the executive of a country that could be joining NATO, as is the current Prime Minister of Sweden. But first, we're going to go on to the topic, which is exercised diplomats and people all around the world, which is the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Specifically, I believe we're at a turning point at the moment, or at least potentially at a turning point, with these current Russian advances in eastern Ukraine.
Krish, towns like Severodonetsk and the town nearby Lyman, it's reported tonight, are close to being taken by the Russians. And if that advance continues, it is significant in terms of the Russians' so-called second phase of this war, taking the Donbass. Yesterday, President Zelensky of Ukraine spoke about up to 100 Ukrainian soldiers every day losing their lives in Donbass. Now, the front line, of course, is hundreds of miles long, and these artillery duels continue along its length with an incredible amount of ferocity, as myself and our team here discovered firsthand this morning. The military section at Kharkiv Cemetery is a graveyard of two halves. You can tell where the dividing line is by the flags. Some are faded, tattered, adorn the headstones of soldiers, many of whom died in the last conflict down in Donbass 8 years ago. The flags in the other part, though, are new. They are vivid. The soil is fresh. The families at the very first stage of grief.
Greg Sutel, I'm going to come to you first, sir. The Russians have undoubtedly made advances in eastern Ukraine in the last week. Is this the vaunted Russian offensive that we were told was going to happen after they withdrew from northern Ukraine? And what capacity do the Ukrainians, do you believe, have to stop this advance?
My personal feeling, and I'm not a military expert, but my personal feeling is this isn't at all that advance. I mean, that was supposed to be an advance to encircle all of Donbass. What they have seemed to have done is focused on this little area around Severodonetsk. And they do seem to be making some progress, but it seems to be only a progress of maybe a kilometer or a mile a day. Certainly nothing like the Ukrainian counteroffensive outside of Kharkiv, which I think 2 weeks ago, you know, they moved 25, 30 miles in a week and now seem to be consolidating those gains. But this is really the first time that Russia seems to be making real progress. And that in itself is interesting and worrying and underlines the need for the Western allies to give more support to Ukraine.
Greg says that the West needs to give more support to Ukraine. At least from a Russian perspective, it seems to me like the West is doing an awful lot to support Ukraine. Is there anything materially or diplomatically that the West could be doing, or specifically Poland could be doing, to help with the Russian advances in the east of its country?
This is a very good question. And especially because it seems that the nature of this war is also protean, so to say. So in the first phase, the Russians wanted to occupy Ukraine basically very quickly. They the Kremlin believes that Ukraine is a kind of a rough state, which you can just occupy within 3 days. Well, this wasn't successful, so they changed this strategy, and they basically now put stress on two goals. The first goal is to focus on the eastern Ukraine, and this is unfortunately looking quite successful right now. So whereas a couple of weeks ago they basically only had Kherson, now they do have Mariupol, they do have Donetsk, Luhansk. So it seems that this eastern concentration was the concentration on the eastern part of Ukraine is a quite effective one. Secondly, however, what they want to do is they want to make this war as long as possible. So apart from this. These eastern steps that they are doing, they are probably, most probably, going to send some bombs, some planes to Kyiv, to Lviv, from time to time. right? So this is going to be a very long war. Now, in this situation, what more can the West do? I think there are still the same two most important ways of help. The first, of course, is diplomatic, and I think there is it's not possible to do enough. You always have to do as much as possible diplomatically, always trying to lead to any kind of consensus here. Well, secondly, unfortunately, this also seems that, well, diplomacy is important, but it's not enough. So the West will have to continue sending weapons to Ukraine and sending material aid, medical aid, and also with time, also probably creating some kind of a new Marshall Plan in order to save Ukrainian economy.
Thank you for that full answer. Greg Sotelong, I'm going to come back to you, Greg. The Russian plan seems to be to capture the rest of the Luhansk Oblast. If the Russians capture this, let's say the next 2 weeks, and then fortify their positions, will that put pressure on Zelensky and the Ukrainians to come to an accommodation with Putin's Russia soon?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that if there's been a consistent error throughout this crisis, it's that observers have continually underestimated both Ukrainian resolve and Ukrainian capability. And so let's say they do take the rest of. So what happens after that? We're still going to be in a war of attrition. Russia is still going to have to supply its troops with something more than the, you know, 1970s era tanks it seems to be sending in there now. And the West needs to continually supply Ukraine. Really, it's sort of a race between how long Russia can hold out and what kind of resolve there is to keep supporting Ukraine. A number of experts have put the tipping point somewhere around August, September, a number of different reasons where things in Russia really, really start going downhill. That remains to be seen, but I think that's we need to really watch, not so much the one in Luhansk, but the battle for Western resolve.
Dr. Dan, you're an ex-military man. Welcome to the stage. Have you been surprised that the Russians have been able to at least rally and actually to advance? I think the overwhelming narrative has been, at least us in the West, has been Russia had its ass kicked in northern Ukraine, and then it decided to strategically withdraw, knowing that it couldn't affect regime change. It then said, or at least analysts thought, there'd be a big push in the east immediately afterwards. That did not happen. But we are seeing these advances now after they have a new supreme commander who's looking at the whole of the battle space. From a military point of view, are the Russians completely and utterly reordering their military forces? And is this something which we should be wary of, considering, as Greg has told us, that they're pulling out mothball tanks? So egregious have their losses actually been in eastern Ukraine.
Yeah, thanks, Roy, for the great question. I'm not a full military tactician. My background was an infantry military officer. And looking at the battlefield space and the response, I'm not surprised about anything. One of the real things is that there's always the fog of war, and it's a push and pull. And when you're having a combination of sorts of war, so this is like urban warfare meets some high terrain and different terrain type warfare, you have to balance some of the things, the logistics, all the things that we've seen and that many have pontificated over. So I'll spare the room and spare the topic. So I'm not surprised, is my point. But I do think, to Greg's point, it literally is the resolve on both sides. Western support and time to default and economic sanctions and all the other things that will affect the Russian resolve on that side. And then the other players, be however you decide to call them, bad actors, supporters on both sides, where they fall in as people start to ally themselves. How long can they hold out? What's in it for them and their citizens or for their political aspirations? So there are many factors to the battlefield play. And as people choose sides, countries choose sides specifically with their voting or with their non-voting, these will affect that landscape. So I would say that. But when you talk about what's going on the ground, yeah, I think it's more of supply. It's more of resource and continuous resource. And where does it become that thin line where it is the Western allies and all the allies are called out saying that they are supporting the war, not like it's something new, but where it becomes an excuse to then say, well, therefore, because you're doing X, Y, Z, this is a declaration of war. I think that's going to come into play as a tactic, as a final corner tactic. I'm done.
Thank you, Dr. Dan. Ben Mendelsohn, let's move to you in West Africa. One of the ramifications of the blockade of Ukraine's ports is that its grain shipments, which many of them go to Africa, have been blocked, have been stopped. And this comes at a time when certain people now have looked around at Africa's support or ambivalence, dare I say, for its support of Ukraine. Is there a real worry in, let's say, in Burkina Faso that the grain shipments to Africa are going to start a food crisis? Obviously, it has inflationary pressures throughout the rest of the world, but they seem to be potentially more acute for Africa. How is Africa viewing the blockage of those Black Sea ports?
It's actually pretty vital right now. It's another crisis. And you know, frankly, in West Africa right now, there's a bit of crisis fatigue because it's like one thing after another. But food security is actually the most immediate issue. They've always been both Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger are sort of the three countries in the Sahel region. Who all have had the largest needs. There's like 22 million people here in Burkina Faso, and 2 million people have been displaced from the north because of jihadist terrorists. So their security issues are a crisis. Then there was coups both in Mali and in Burkina Faso and in Guinea. So there's unstable government issues. And then there's been a drought here, so that it's been hard for them to produce the grains that they have here and, you know, coming from climate change. So it becomes a ripple effect. So right now, they're razor focused on the invasion of Russia and Ukraine. They really need to get that grain delivered here within the next couple of months because, you know, they have expectations of having problems seasonally. And it's now getting into the point where within the next month, they need a lot more help than normal. So it's definitely top of mind.
May I ask Ben a quick question, Rafael?
Absolutely.
So Ben, your wife is actually the Brazilian ambassador to Burkina Faso. And I know that Brazil has their own issues with agriculture, especially with the lack of potash coming from the region, from Belarus and other places, is really affecting the agricultural sector in Brazil. So how does that play out? Because it seems to me you have an almost unique perch of views of both into Brazil and into Africa.
Yeah, thank you for that, Greg. You're absolutely right. Agriculture in Brazil is one of its largest industries, and they also export a lot, but they are dependent on Russian fertilizer. And that's partially one of the reasons why they've been a little reticent of going against Russia and being too much towards Ukraine. So it affects their foreign policy as well. So it is interesting because we're sort of caught in the middle. So we're at the you know, in one point we're being pulled to try to do what we can to help you know, people in need here in West Africa, and at the same time there are, you know, very specific issues in Brazil, particularly because there's a very important national election coming up in October. So a lot of the decisions are being made politically, and that complicates matters.
Thank you for that excellent question, Greg. And it touched on something where I want to go next, which was the kind of diplomatic support. Because if we look at the whole 54 nations that make up the continent of Africa, it's veered from outright support for Ukraine to actually Eritrea being a fervent supporter of Putin. But many African regimes being somewhat in the middle, and Ben, you've told us there that there is a very solid reason why, other than just the symbolic rape and invasion of one country by another. There are other concerns which other regimes have. Michael, I'm going to come to you. If this conflict is going to go on for, let's say, 9 months, 12 months, 2 years, do you think America will potentially, tire is the wrong word, but I can't think of a better word right now, be fatigued with constant Ukrainian demands, requests is probably a more apropos word, for extra military support? Do you think that America and the West actually have the fortitude for a long engagement in Ukraine in terms of being its main military supplier?
Well, I think there's an argument to be made that the U.S. is used to being in a state of fatigue for many things. So, you know, there's already been pushback about Biden's $40 billion installment to Ukraine. And I think it's going to really depend on the state of the U.S. economy. If it does last multiple years, which I'm really not of the mind that it will be. The Treasury yesterday blocked Russia from using U.S. banks as a conduit to pay off Russian debt obligations. The central bank in Russia cut the interest rate of the ruble again because of the internal demand of Russian exporters being forced legally to convert dollars into rubles. And, you know, the fact that petrodollars are the language of the oil industry, I think things are going to be very, very difficult for Russia financially over the next several months. Not to mention, you know, as someone mentioned before, the military issues with the T-62 tanks and them basically removing any upper age limit for new recruits in Russia. So now they can recruit 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds, 70-year-olds. If they volunteer. So I'm not as pessimistic, I don't think, as many are, but maybe that's just me and maybe that's just my optimism. But I think America, as long as we're not really focused on it, we seem to be able to endure quite a bit of fatigue as long as it's sort of a background noise.
Thank you for that, Michael. Andrea, I'm going to come to you. What one thing that this crisis has done, this invasion has done, is to reinvigorate NATO. NATO has gone from being an almost semi-forgotten key part of the Western apparatus to something which is key and underpins all of our freedoms. Where do you stand with the accession of Finland and Sweden, and specifically looking at Turkey's objections? Is this just a case of realpolitik? Do we need to take Erdogan around the back of the house, give him a bit of a slap and say, fix up? We have an existential crisis to the Western world on our hands here. This is not a time to play internal Turkish politics on the geopolitical stage. Or do we just say, this is one of the prices you have to pay if you have an organization which has 30 plus members in it, that you are going to have recalcitrant members wanting to politic around widening NATO?
Thanks, Roifeld. I would go with the latter. I think it's perfectly understandable at this point in time that Finland and Sweden would want to join NATO. I think that is very much an unintended consequence for Putin and his actions in Ukraine, despite the debate that's out there about whether NATO expansion has actually triggered all of this. I think Erdogan has to come to terms with this and live with it. And I do, in fact, think that this is the consequence of when you're dealing with a large member organization like that. I'm not an expert per se in this, but I think it's interesting to look into Erdogan's leadership and his ties also to Russia, and I have to say to the former President Donald Trump, and explore his objections even further for what might not exactly be on the table, but what might be behind his objections as well.
Carolina, Poland is very obviously on the front line of the humanitarian crisis outside of Ukraine's borders. We now know that, 5.5 million Ukrainians have left their homes, left their home of Ukraine, and there were some 10 million plus displaced within Ukraine. Could you give us some idea of how Poland is coping with it some 3 months into the invasion?
So Poland has received approximately 3 million of Ukrainians, which is quite a large number. And it's unprecedented after the Second World War in this part of the world. So even if the Germans, for example, received 1 million of Syrian refugees in 2015, they received this million throughout a year. And we received those 3 million of people throughout a couple of weeks or months. So this is quite a difference. But astonishingly, it has been coped very, very well. Why is this? Well, firstly, one says very often today in Poland that Poland is not a state, but rather a big NGO. And it is true that most of the people that have been relocated to Poland have been helped by citizens, by civil society organizations, by NGOs, and this is very important. So you might say that we have a very important civil society moment right now. We haven't had such a moment since the Solidarity Movement in 1980. And this is not only my opinion, it is opinion of many people whom I talk to and many experts. So this is quite remarkable. Remarkable is also that there is not much fatigue in the behavior of people who are helping the Ukrainians. So still people are offering private houses, still they are making sandwiches, giving jobs, raising money, sending arms, sending medical aid, sending food and whatever you wish, actually, to Ukraine. So this is one thing. Another thing I wanted to say is that in this situation, it is only an oversimplification to think that it is only Ukrainians coming into Poland, because actually the movement is in both ways. So you have, on one hand, a lot of people who come, but since March, it is ever fewer people coming in. But you also have, from the very beginning, another story going on. First, those were men who were leaving Poland, for example, in order to take part in defense of Ukraine, Ukrainian men. Now, it is also women and children who are coming back to those regions of Ukraine that seems relatively stable. So, for example, to Western Ukraine. And so this situation is far from being stable. It is very plastic. It changes every day. The dynamics are changing every day.
Just remain with you just for one more question before we move on to our second item. From a Western European perspective, Hungary and Poland were always kind of lumped together as the Eurosceptic, slightly illiberal. I know we talked about this before when you came on to the show a couple of months ago, but they're seen as the slightly illiberal European partners. It seems to be that now your prime minister has put clear blue water between himself and Hungary's position. Is that just my perception, or is that something which is kind of like palpable within Polish politics, that actually Hungary is maybe slightly trying to play both sides of the fence here, whereas Poland is absolutely staunch in its condemnation of Russia's invasion?
Oh, I think it's a little bit different. It's, you know, it's like when we say West, we say it as if it was a monolith, but obviously it's not. The West is the US and Europe and actually Western Europe and Eastern and Central Europe belong in many ways already to the West. So again, exactly like this, if you say Central and Eastern Europe, this is also not a monolith. And in the change of relations between Warsaw and Budapest, you basically see how this monolith falls apart in a new way right now. So this probably is connected with history. Hungary doesn't have this long-term history of experiencing Russian imperialism. Of course, it did experience it, but it is nothing in comparison to what Poland and, for example, the Baltic states experienced. So you don't have to speak to Poles. It is enough to hear what the Kaja Kallas, the Prime Minister of Estonia, says. She says a neighboring house is on fire. Our house is very probable to be on fire soon. This is exactly what the experience of this Russian neighbors is, and it's quite different than the experience of Hungary. So there is a divide clearly between Poland and Hungary. It has been articulated very clearly by various representatives of United Right Coalition in Poland. But let me just add one thing or two things briefly. First thing, I said previously that Poland is an NGO, and this is very important because if you observe the situation closely, you will see that, of course, the government made the right decision to open the border with Ukraine at the very beginning. But as for who receives the refugees, who shows the solidarity, it's not the state. It's the civil society organizations and some local governments. So the government in Warsaw would like to capitalize on that. And this is very important to grasp that. So this is one thing. Another thing, many of my friends from Western countries ask me, well, if you are behaving in such a way, if your government is behaving differently than previously, does it mean that they became perhaps more liberal? No, they didn't. They are not liberal democrats. In fact, they are not democrats at all. They didn't change. They are sovereignists. In this sense, they try to protect Ukrainian sovereignty. And in this respect, their interests are for some time the same interests as the interests of the Western Europe. But once this crisis is over, and sooner or later it will be over, they will go their way. And this way is not liberal democratic.
Thank you for that, Professor Karolina Wigora. Are you in Berlin or in Warsaw at the moment?
Today I am in Warsaw.
There you go. On the spot.
Ask Karolina a question. So, Karolina, I'd be particularly interested to hear your views about how the Polish-Ukrainian relationship has evolved. Because having lived in both countries, it's my perception that 20 years ago, the perception among Poles was that it wasn't very close with Ukrainians. It tended to be somewhat patronizing, and they were considered to be some kind of Russians. Not exactly Russians, but some kind. Yakubin. And that really seemed to shift in 2004 and 5 after the Orange Revolution. Since then, it seems to me that Poland has become more and more entwined with Ukraine and more supportive of Ukraine. Is that how you would say it?
Yes, exactly. I would definitely say so. So you can say that the Poles and Ukrainians have like two histories together. The first history is of Poles actually colonizing that what is today Ukraine. Apart from Russian imperialism in this region, there was also Polish imperialism. And part of this imperialism was to colonize what is today Ukraine and Belarus. And this led to competition, to many resentments, and during the Second World War also to bloody conflict between Poles and Ukrainians with mass murders and revenges. So this is one history of Poles and Ukrainians. And this is a bloody history full of atrocities and full of resentments. But luckily, we also have this second history. And this second history is the history, as you rightly said, of the last, perhaps not even 20, but 30 years. So it is a history of democratic Poland and democratic Ukraine trying to cope with each other, to find a new way they have these relations. And you are right. This did start, the change, the shift on a mass level started in 2004, 2005. So the Orange Revolution first, supporting Mr. Yushchenko, and then going to Kiev, protesting together. This was the first one. The second one, of course, was the Euromaidan. And again, the same thing, marches in Warsaw, in Krakow, in support of Ukrainians, many Poles going to Kiev, helping. And now there is this vast solidarity, which is connected. So still in the older generations in Poland, you might hear, yes, well, but we should remember about Wołyń, etc. But the next sentence, even for those people from the older generations who still remember, the next sentence is, but okay, we'll talk about it later, because now they need help, and that's the whole story. So yes, I think that this is one of the most successful examples of reconciliation in politics.
Thank you for that, Karolina. But now is the point, if you're in the audience, if you would like to contribute on the Russian advances in eastern Ukraine, or just on the whole Ukrainian battle space, now is the time. So if you're in the audience, raise your hand and we'll call you up. But I am going to institute a Greg Sattel rule, considering that time is very much of the essence. Only make one point, please. Rob Gillian, you've come up on stage. Speak now, sir.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Royfield Brown. Via the Ukraine, the United States, and I was going to say calls to action or whatever. I'm looking at an article. This is on the World War I Centenary site, subtitled Continuations and Beginnings. The article is called The Rape of Belgium Revisited. So there's entreaties from both sides all around the world. Again, pro and whatever you want to call anti-Ukraine. I saw a large lit digital billboard in North Carolina, driving west out of Charlotte, North Carolina, that said, "We stand with Ukraine." But I'm just saying there's propaganda on both sides. It's difficult to, in some ways, if you're trying to look at something from a pragmatic, let's say, balanced point of view, it's very difficult to do. I mean, one side says, well, we have the more compelling argument, or this is the reason for why this has occurred. Again, looking at the title of the room, Mid-Atlantic, I am from the Mid-Atlantic, as far as states are concerned with the United States, so the title is a bit confusing. So if the title means we're meeting in the middle of Atlantic, say Americans and British, European continentals, then, you know, perhaps that's how that's informed. But at least in my mind, Americans that are viewing this as far as like from a detached, pragmatic point of view, we see a lot of entreaties to both sides. And I would equate that to some of the things that occurred during the First World War with the struggle for Europe.
All right, Rob, in the West. Rob, yes. You know what? Because time is so of the essence.
Certainly, I'll cut it off. Certainly.
All right.
Thank you.
But you jumped in and made your point. And just for what it's worth, if I was starting the podcast now, as opposed to when I did in 2014 before coming to California. I would never have called it Mid-Atlantic. To me, yes, it means the meeting of two cultures in the middle of the Atlantic. I was not aware of the Mid-Atlantic states being coined as such. But there you go. I should have done my research. Literally just one point. If you'd like to speak on Ukraine, please just flash your mic if you just come on to the stage. All right, Piotr, just quickly though, just one point, because we are going to move on to our second item. So, Piotr Kurzon.
The Turks are being problematic with the Swedes, particularly the Swedes and the Finns primarily because of their funding and a sort of obstruction to a certain treaty. But the Swedes, it's all to do with the PKK. This is primarily a domestic issue. With Erdogan up for re-election next year, and him wanting to look as a strong man in his domestic issues, the Turks care first and foremost about the economy, as almost any population do in any election. So that is going to be a sticking point, and frankly, I'm surprised by the lack of acknowledgement it has had in terms of reaction. The NATO alliance, I think, in large parts are hoping that it will just sort of be dealt with and go away. Assuming that the sort of the Swedes and the Finns, being one of the more agreeable groups, will sort of find some way forward with the Turks. But that being said, the foreign minister of Turkey will be meeting, I think, Blinken, is it tomorrow or sometime soon? And I guarantee you that will be high on the agenda. The Americans trying to find a way to maybe not appease the Turks, but at least be like, all right, look, if you do this, then we'll do that for you, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, Russian advancements, I wouldn't overplay these, if I'm honest. It's not great, but the biggest win continues and will be for the entirety of the war at this point, I think, Mariupol. The wins that they've got in the Donbass region are very minuscule. Fighting is deadly, from what I've been reading and from friends on the ground who are there. That have been telling me, but in terms of actual impact on Russia's greater grand strategy in the Donbass region, you just have to put it in the context of what Russia originally wanted. So it's a complete and utter mess for them. We'll see the overarching impacts, I think, of this $14 billion bill by the US coming to fruition quite soon. So, wait and see. I think the next couple of weeks could be quite interesting in terms of just how much greater support this momentum this could give the Ukrainian forces. That being said, I was reading, and in the Ukraine sit-rep room we had, I was listening in, but that's the beauty of the room. We had people come and share suddenly that apparently the Americans and some Western allies are beginning to be like, well, we can't continue to fund you or at least provide you the arms that you're demanding. Ukraine. That wasn't verified, but it was something that was apparently in French and German news. So that's something I'm going to keep a lookout for, because as I said from early on, at the beginning of the month, it may the end of the war or a concession to the war and some kind of negotiation may not well come from the Russians or the Ukrainians. It may well come from the West's alliance being like, look, Ukraine, we physically cannot keep this up in terms of supporting you. The global ramifications and destabilization that will come from this and your unwillingness to give up the territory is just not something we can support. So it might be that the Ukrainians are forced to come to some kind of peace agreement. Again, I'm making a lot of conjectures here, but they may be forced to sort of come to the table to at least properly begin negotiating, just because the West are like, look, we can't keep this up for the sake of the global economy. That's where my mind's been in the past few days, and I'll hand back to you.
Thank you for that, Mr. K. We did touch on a few of those issues and points, but thank you for condensing them into a nice little end of this segment. So I'm taking it that nobody else on stage wants to contribute about Ukraine. If you do, quickly flash your mic. Otherwise, it's going to be time to move on. Carolina, thank you for joining us. I know it's a little bit late for you. You can now safely go. I said 1 hour. I think I've just about delivered on that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much for having me here again.
And listen, thank you for providing your expert commentary and insight. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dobra noc.
Thank you. Dobra noc.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Fundamentally, what this room is about is to try and understand US and UK politics, but also to promote civil discourse. I think we can all see that at a time when many opinion writers are saying that America is going through a cold civil war, and we've had Brexit, which exposed so many fissures within UK society, the time for us, whether we are right or left, to still to be able to communicate and converse with each other is even more important. And that's what this room tries to promote. I've always been of the belief that the Commonwealth, the common ground, is absolutely vitally important. And it's for all of us, whether we're left or right, to inhabit that ground and to stake a claim to it, and to metaphorically be able to meet each other, whether we agree or disagree with their politics. So that's what Mid-Atlantic is all about. There you go. That's been me, Royfield Brown. You can back-channel me. You can send me an email at royfield@gmail.com if you'd like to discuss future shows. I'm going to try and do these once a week. Toodle pip, goodbye. Look after yourselves. Look after your loved ones. And make sure that you look after yourself also. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.